You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Killer Instincts by Rachel Dodds. Noguera turned his life around in prison. His mixed-media paintings, using acrylic paint, newspaper clippings, and ground-up prison yard concrete have earned him awards and gallery representation. His work is currently exhibited at the Elder Gallery of Contemporary Art in Charlotte, North Carolina, owned by attorney Sonia Pfeiffer, the wife of David Rudolph, the criminal defense lawyer who represented Michael Peterson. In the murder trial, dramatized in Netflix's The Staircase, in 2021, Noguera launched Death Row Diaries, billed as the only podcast hosted live from Death Row. In 2018, he published a memoir, Escape Artist, Memoir of a Visionary Artist on Death Row, Seven Stories Press, and he's also written another book based on his relationship with Nasso, Through the Lens of a Monster, slated to be published in September by Sandra Jonas Publishing. Since partnering with Maines, he has also appeared via phone on about 20 episodes of Maines' YouTube show, Unsolved No More, where they discuss murder cases in the news. Noguera is not lying about who he is. He is a respected convict who was not a troublemaker, Dan Long, a San Quentin corrections officer on Noguera's cell block, wrote to Maines in an email in January 2023 after seeing Noguera featured on Unsolved No More. Well-read and direct, with a white Van Dyke-style beard, Noguera sounds more like a professor than a convicted murderer. In some ways, that's what he is. Even though he's been behind bars for most of his life, he spent decades reading and seeing the world through the lens of those who have experienced it from a unique perspective, he tells me. People like the poet Lautremont, the philosopher Alfred North Whitehead, and artists like Mark Rothko and Robert Motherwell. Inspired by such thinkers, he made a decision to use his experiences inside the walls of San Quentin to turn his life sentence into his life's mission, studying serial killers as if he were a cultural anthropologist in an effort to get them to spill their secrets. "I lived for 40 years with serial killers," says Noguera. "There's not an expert in the field who has the thesis, the research, and the one-on-one time with serial killers that I have." Noguera methodically observed serial killers' behavior by talking with them and earning their trust. He then took detailed notes in neat, tiny handwriting with loopy Y's and J's upon returning to his home, a 4.5 by 9.5 foot cell on the fourth tier of San Quentin's East Block, nicknamed the Pigeon Cage, to describe this cavernous five-story concrete hive of 528 cells. Noguera, inmate number D77200, was in cell 77. Like any researcher conducting a longitudinal study, Noguera would ask the killers the same questions after a year, 5 years, then 10 years, cross-checking his notes to see which responses remained the same. "I really believe in consistency of behavior," says Noguera. For example, he noticed that serial killers often boast about events that turn out to be untrue. But since they remember their crimes so vividly, if their story changes, even slight details, such as what they were wearing, he knows they are lying. Noguera first became interested in serial killers while he was awaiting trial at the Orange County Jail. He found himself in a cell adjacent to dating game killer Rodney Alcala and Randy Kraft, the scorecard killer, both of whom had been charged with murdering children. As he sees it, the killing of a child, which is how he views his former girlfriend's abortion, is what precipitated his own crime. The loss of a child is something that resonates with me because I lost my child, Noguera told me. Growing up in La Puente, California, a gang-ridden suburban city in Los Angeles County, with an abusive alcoholic father whom he simultaneously worshipped and feared, Noguera became a quick study of human behavior. In his memoir, dedicated to his father, who died in 2022, he writes that out of necessity, he honed an ability to read body language and nonverbal cues as a survival mechanism. As a teenage middleweight champion in Hapkido, a Korean martial art, he became adept at predicting how opponents would move, a skill he credits with saving his life on multiple occasions, both before and during his incarceration. By the time he was charged with murder, Noguera felt he understood many types of criminals, gang members, drug kingpins, car thieves, but his serial killer cellmates at the Orange County Jail baffled him. Figuring out what could possibly compel these men to kill innocent strangers, and furthermore to derive pleasure from the act of killing, became a hobby, if you want to call it that, he says. The 1970s through the 1990s, an era before ubiquitous security cameras, smartphones, GPS, DNA testing, and national databases, is often called the Golden Age of serial killers, a term first coined by author Harold Schechter, who has written more than 24 true crime books, including the A to Z Encyclopedia of Serial Killers. One of them, William Bonin, the freeway killer, known for raping and torturing young men and boys, had even tried to kidnap Noguera at a California bus stop, not once, but twice, when Noguera was 11 and again when he was 15. When he arrived at San Quentin, Noguera says that Bonin instantly recognized him and called him his unicorn. It was Bonin who paved the way for Noguera to get to know other serial killers. Bonin was executed by lethal injection in 1996. Fewer than 1% of murders in any given year are due to serial killers, but their randomness and brutality are especially terrifying, which partly explains our enduring cultural fascination with them. Noguera calls them the apex predators of civil society, but on death row, they are considered pathetic vermin, the lowest form of life, more likely to be stabbed by a prison gang member with a makeshift shank than executed by the state. Because of this, at San Quentin, serial killers were kept isolated from the rest of the death row population. If you get around a serial killer, you are to kill him, because serial killers give convicts a bad name, says Noguera, citing the convict code, unwritten guidelines that govern inmate behavior and are shared only with convicts deemed worthy to receive them. Nasso's trial in the summer of 2013 was described in press reports as a bizarre spectacle. Nasso acted as his own attorney and referred to himself in the third person, demanding that the judge release Joseph Nasso from jail immediately. He flipped the bird at the jury and victims' families, calling the female deputy district attorney a whore, and insisted the photographs he took of naked women, some of whom were believed to be deceased, was his art. He cross-examined the famous forensic psychiatrist Park Dietz, as well as his own ex-wife, Judith, who testified that Nasso had drugged her and invited strangers to rape her while he looked on, then gaslit her when she tried to confront him. Judith Nasso died in 2016. Nasso's sons, Charles and David, now 62 and 59 respectively, did not attend the trial. In a photograph by Ryan Pfluger, Freedom, Noguera was able to visit the water for the first time in more than 40 years when he was released from prison this summer, photographed on July 7th in Brea, California. Charles, who was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and has a long rap sheet of his own, was moved into a psychiatric facility in Nevada in the early 2000s. David reportedly lives in Hawaii and did not respond to Vanity Fair's attempts to reach him. It is unclear if he still speaks to his father, but investors discovered that Nasso liquidated almost $300,000 in assets following his arrest and transferred that money to David, who, according to Marin County prosecutors, may have then been living in the Philippines. Pedro Oliveros, who was appointed Nasso's advisory counsel, remembers the trial being like a circus. His client objected to the prosecution snuggling with a witness because he, serving as the defense as well as the defendant, had to remain far away. There was also Nasso's motion demanding that nobody drink coffee in the courthouse because since Nasso wasn't allowed to have coffee, it gave the prosecution an unfair advantage. Now retired, Oliveros says the case was one of the most challenging assignments in my 34-year career as a public defender. Because, as much as he advised his client, Nasso was ultimately in control of everything. Marin County sued Nasso after his conviction to try to recoup the $170,000 spent on his case, including legal fees owed to Oliveros. Nasso appealed the judgment, but the appeal was dismissed because it was filed in 2021, 7 years after the initial 2014 ruling, far exceeding the 30-day deadline. Next photos, Charlotte Cook and Tracy Tafoya seeking justice. Victims included Pamela Lamson, believed to be number four girl on Mount Tam, and Roxine Ragosh, believed to be number three girl near Lagunitas. Rachel Smith, the daughter of one of Nasso's victims, was at the trial and remembers it all too well. He was a smug son of a bitch, very disrespectful, says Smith, who was just 4 years old when Nasso murdered her mother, Carmen Colon. By the time Nasso was charged, Smith was a 36-year-old addict who had struggled her entire life to process her mother's death. I didn't start healing until the trial, says Smith, who is now 51, in recovery, and studying for a degree in social work. The jury reached a verdict in less than 4 hours. At age 79, Nasso became the oldest person in California history to be sentenced to death. He's currently the second oldest death row inmate in the state. Trailside killer David Carpenter is a few years older at 95. In the one interview Nasso gave at the Marin County Jail after his conviction, he laughed as ABC San Francisco reporter Dan Noyes showed him a photograph of the mannequins hanging in his garage. Nasso described the image as my family picture. When asked to explain why his ex-wife's DNA was found on pantyhose wrapped around one victim's neck, Nasso told Noyes with a smirk, "You'll have to ask my wife." By the time Nasso was transferred to San Quentin in November 2013, Noguera had become known by prison officials as a model inmate. The warden had just offered him a newly created role with the Inmate Disability Assistance Program, IDAP, for which he was paid $60 per month. That involved daily visits to the medically restricted yard, where the inmates were either old, disabled, or required segregation from the general population for their own safety. Many in the third category happened to be serial killers. They largely kept to themselves, avoiding confrontation with inmates who were well-versed in the convict code. But Nasso was different. He walked right up to Noguera and boldly asked what he was doing there. Noguera explained that he was in the yard to assist him and others with any physical issues they may have, like putting on clothes, exercising, and getting in and out of a wheelchair. Nasso then tried to hustle Noguera, telling him he could really use a good cup of coffee and some candy bars. The following day, Noguera delivered. Nasso was chatty. "I know a lot about you," Nasso told Noguera. "You're a famous artist. Everybody knows who you are in here. I'm an artist, too." Right off the bat, Noguera could tell that Nasso was a narcissist. In a 2009 psychological evaluation following a shoplifting arrest, a doctor noted that Nasso believes he is a celebrity and special. Nasso continually bragged about his Hollywood connections and showed Nogueira a photo of himself with the actor Jay Moore on the set of a 1998 film called Jane Austen's Mafia, in which Nasso was an uncredited extra. Nasso told Nogueira that he and Moore were friends. Moore says he doesn't know the guy. The actor's manager, Barry Katz, wrote in a text message. Nasso also showed off his collection of pictures of himself with stars like Anthony Hopkins, Glenn Close, and Michelle Pfeiffer. One day, Nasso gave Nogueira a piece of his own art, a collage of 11 headshots of different women encircling Nasso's black and white self-portrait. "Best wishes to Bill," Nasso wrote at the bottom of the collage, "from me and friends, Joe Nasso." The collage sent a chill down Nogueira's spine. He asked Nasso how many of the women pictured were still alive. Nasso took his index finger, hit his temple, and said, "They're all alive right here," then erupted in laughter, Nogueira recalls. It was creepy as hell. Although it was dangerous for Nogueira to be seen hanging out with a serial killer, over the years he had cultivated a reputation as a man not to be messed with. At 6'1" and 200 pounds, and trained in martial arts, he could hold his own. "I have a mask of a really not nice guy," Nogueira admits to me. "I was feared by other killers because of my reputation of using violence as a tool, and I was extremely good at it." In his memoir, he describes a fight with a paranoid murderer named Hellhound, who accused Nogueira of bugging his cell and struck him in the head. In response, Nogueira smashed Hellhound's nose, fractured his eye socket, and knocked out some of his teeth. Descriptions of incidents like this were watered down in the book, Nogueira says, because he didn't want to glorify violence. Not mentioned was the fact that Hellhound's face was permanently disfigured after the beating. He spoke with a lisp, had one droopy eye, and never returned to the yard. Next photos, Rebecca Jean Dunn, Pamela Lamson, Roxine Ragash. Death Row Confidential, Secrets of a Serial Killer, a documentary produced by Wolf Entertainment, Fireside Pictures, Universal Television Alternative Studio, and Vanity Fair Studios, premiered at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, September 13th, on Oxygen. Nogueira leveraged his tough reputation to get closer to Nasso when he got into a fight with another inmate. Nasso bumped into Rockhead, an Aryan Brotherhood member who had been separated from other gang members who were plotting to kill him for snitching. But instead of apologizing to Rockhead, who was bigger than Nasso, he said something like, "Watch where you're going, asshole," Nogueira recalls. Rockhead left Nasso so badly bruised and terrified that he begged Nogueira to be his protector. Nogueira was only too willing to get closer for his research. "I said, Joe, Rockhead's going to rape you," and Joe just completely panicked, which was kind of funny because he's a rapist, recalls Nogueira. He ultimately agreed to protect Nasso, but only if he did exactly what Nogueira asked. Nasso nervously agreed. "We're friends, right?" Nasso sheepishly asked Nogueira, who smiled and assured him, "We're more than friends, Joe. We're crime partners." By 2015, Nasso felt more comfortable in the yard with his influential friend and crime partner. He would fantasize aloud about hitting the road with Nogueira and going on a raping spree in Los Angeles. Or, as Nasso put it, two artists at work getting whores, Nogueira wrote in his notes. Nasso started asking Nogueira for more complicated favors, like whether he could procure women's underwear, lipstick, a bra, and bondage porn. Nogueira assured him he had friends in places high and low. He then would disappear for a few days to psychologically torment Nasso. In a note to himself, dated May 21st, 2015, Nogueira describes telling Nasso that he got the underwear. "He nearly jumped out of his skin," Nogueira wrote. The following week, Nogueira says, Nasso pulled down his pants right there in the yard to reveal that he was wearing it. At times, pretending to be pals was emotionally exhausting for Nogueira, not to mention dangerous. But Nogueira persisted in his mission. I'm sometimes relieved when Nasso doesn't come out, Nogueira wrote in his notes to himself. He's a monster, and wearing a mask to fool him is not easy. Must continue. There's a bigger purpose to think about. Victim's family. By the end of 2015, 2 years after they first met, Nasso finally started opening up to Nogueira about the details of his crimes. He bragged that the cops got it all wrong, according to Nogueira's journal. The list of 10 was merely his greatest hits, his favorites, he said. His real kill number, he told Nogueira, was 26. Maines noted that investigators found a collection of 26 gold coins inside Nasso's house. Nasso described driving around on the hunt for victims while listening to The Doors' Riders on the Storm, over and over, because he liked the line, "There's a killer on the road, his brain is squirming like a toad." Nogueira says that Nasso revealed that one of his murders was incorrectly pinned on a fellow San Quentin inmate, dating game killer Alcala, whom Nasso despised because Alcala was identified as a professional photographer in media reports. That really bothered him, recalls Nogueira, so he often talked about how they got him for one of mine. Nasso also told Nogueira why he killed. He believed all women to be secret whores who use their sexuality to control men. Nogueira says that Nasso told him about the time when he was just a kid, 9 or 10 years old, and his mother caught him trying on her lingerie. Furious, she beat him with a belt, and subsequently began calling him her daughter, and gave him a nickname, Miss Josie. Shortly thereafter, while peeping through the window of his mother's bedroom, Nasso was a voyeur even as a child. He observed her wearing the lingerie while having sex with a neighbor, asking the neighbor to choke her. This confirmed Nasso's beliefs about women in general and his mother in particular. She was a liar, a hypocrite, and a whore. To get her back, he strangled her beloved pet bird. By taking photos of victims after he had allegedly raped and strangled them to death, sometimes engaging in necrophilia, Nasso told Nogueira he was showing women who was really the boss and making them clean and perfect again. He then used his photographs to relive the crimes. I am called to kill. It truly calls to me, and I answer its call, he told Nogueira, according to his notes. Nasso, well-versed in the biographies of other famous serial killers and rapists, frequently expressed his admiration of and lifelong devotion to the red light bandit, Carl Chessman, a serial rapist in the 1940s. Police had found correspondence between Nasso and Chessman, along with an invitation to Chessman's execution, which took place at San Quentin in 1960. By targeting women with first and last names that began with the same letter, like Carmen Colon and Charlotte Cook, investigators believe Nasso was paying tribute to his mentor. Even as he joked about his crimes, Nasso was desperate to get off death row. Whining to Nogueira that he was just a tired old man and no longer a threat to anyone, this suddenly gave Nogueira an idea. He told Nasso that he had a friend, Walt Pavlo Jr., who played golf with Gavin Newsom. If Nasso could offer a good-faith token by admitting to an unsolved murder, maybe his pal Walt could put in a good word with the governor, the only man with the power to get Nasso moved out of San Quentin and into a more comfortable facility. Pavlo, a former executive at MCI WorldCom, who served 2 years in a federal prison for wire fraud and obstruction of justice, had been introduced to Nogueira through a mutual friend. The author of a book, Stolen Without a Gun, Confessions from Inside History's Biggest Accounting Fraud, Pablo has covered Nogueira's case for Forbes magazine, where he's now a contributor, and invited Nogueira to guest lecture at Endicott College, where he was an adjunct professor. He and Nogueira really are friends. Pablo wrote the foreword to Nogueira's memoir, comparing him to Pablo Picasso. But he does not play golf with Newsom. Nogueira fabricated that detail in the heat of the moment to appeal to Nasso, who had reminisced in a note to Nogueira about his time as a champion caddy at a prominent, prestigious New York country club, where he observed that big people make big deals not in the office, but on the golf course. As Nogueira was scamming Nasso to confess to more murders, he was simultaneously working to get off death row himself. In 2017, following years of appeals, stays of execution, hearings, and delays, a federal judge reversed Nogueira's conviction on the grounds that his lawyer had prevented him from getting a fair trial and ordered him either released from prison or retried within 120 days. Unfortunately for Nogueira, the decision was appealed to the Ninth Circuit by the Attorney General of California, tossing him once again into legal purgatory. At the time, Nogueira had been making steady progress with Nasso, but hadn't yet extracted enough information to tie him to a specific murder. Depending on what the Ninth Circuit would decide, his time with Nasso could be running out, rendering all those years he spent befriending him worthless. Plus, Nasso's health was rapidly deteriorating. His hygiene was abysmal, his teeth were brown and falling out, and he smelled so bad that Nogueira often had to hold his breath around him, even when they were outdoors. At one point, Nasso collapsed in the yard and had to be rushed to the hospital for heart surgery. An irony not lost on Nogueira, who saw it as an absurdist exercise in wasting taxpayer money to save a man's life just so that the state could later waste more taxpayer money to kill him. "Must hurry. Nasso may not be here much longer," Nogueira wrote in his notes. To persuade Nasso that he had connections inside the judicial system, he decided to bring to the yard the court order stating that his conviction had been reversed, not mentioning, of course, that the order had since been appealed and might soon be reinstated. According to Nogueira, Nasso was so impressed with the document that a few days after seeing it, he presented Nogueira with a handwritten confession to a murder, matching number 6 on his list of 10, the girl from Berkeley. "Nasso did what I never thought he'd do," Nogueira wrote in an April 2019 journal entry. "He admitted on paper, confessed, to killing girl from Berkeley. Wants me to give this letter to my friend to begin talks with governor. I'll play this out as long as I can." Over the next year, Nogueira strung Nasso along, pressing him to add more details to bolster his confession, because he said his buddy Pablo needed a real sign of good faith if he was going to take Nasso's case up with Newsom. Nogueira made Nasso promise not to tell anyone about their secret plan, because he was aware that anyone who heard about it would not only know it was total bullshit, but would come after Nogueira for being a snitch. Despite the risk, the scheme worked. In June 2020, Nasso handed Nogueira an expanded 2-page confession letter about the girl from Berkeley. Nogueira says his stomach clenched as he read Nasso's all-caps handwriting, recalling how sometime in the late 1960s or early 1970s, Nasso responded to an ad in the countercultural newspaper The Berkeley Barb from a young woman seeking nude modeling gigs. The woman rode her bike to meet Nasso and chained it up at the meeting place, after which he brought her back to his home in Oakland for a photo shoot. He knew his wife and kids would be out at that time. She was nice-looking, with long brown hair, and seemed to have a good figure. "I guess about 5'4 and 120 pounds," he wrote. He couldn't recall her name, noting that he had no intention to date her. "I had her lay on her back on my sofa for some topless shots. During this session, I choked her to death. No violence, no sex, just a quick death, he wrote, before describing matter-of-factly how he put her body in a trash bag in the trunk of his car and drove to the San Rafael Bridge, where he tossed it into the bay, boasting that it wasn't easy, but back then I had the vigor. Now that he had a confession and 300 pages of his own meticulous notes about Naso, Nogueira started writing letters to more than a dozen private investigators who he hoped could identify the girl from Berkeley while keeping Nogueira's own identity confidential for the time being. If his name got out while he was still at San Quentin, it will be all over death row. I'll be killed, he wrote. Almost none of the investigators responded, and the few who did required retainers. 2 years later, Nogueira was still stuck at San Quentin, awaiting a ruling from the Ninth Circuit, taking more notes and polishing up a manuscript he decided to write about his time with Naso, his new plan. Then one day, in his cell on the fourth tier of East Block, he was watching The Hunt for the Zodiac Killer on the History Channel, featuring an expert in cold cases. That expert was Kenneth Mains. The way he spoke, it made me interested in him as a person with integrity, as well as credibility as a profiler and investigator, recalls Nogueira. He sent Mains a letter pleading for his help. I need you to put the puzzle together, which I cannot do from prison. Mains didn't know what to think about the letter from a convicted murderer on death row. I always feel that there's an angle, some way that I'm going to get played, he says now. But there was something about Nogueira's story that made Mains feel he deserved at least to be heard. I do not and will not ever judge someone as I haven't walked in their shoes, Mains wrote back to Nogueira. Your accomplishments inside those walls are honorable, and you should be commended for that. Your artwork isn't too shabby either, haha. Mains says that like Nogueira and the families of victims he's trying to help, he could also relate to the pain of losing a child. On his left arm, amid a full sleeve of tattoos, he has one that says, "Come sit beside me, my only son." It's a lyric from the Lynyrd Skynyrd song Simple Man, a tribute to his son Eric, who died in 2013 at age 21 after struggling with drug addiction. Unlike the other investigators Nogueira had reached out to, Mains offered to work pro bono because, he tells me, it's in my DNA to be a cold case detective. It's just what I do, and money isn't everything. To familiarize Mains with everything he knew, Nogueira had his lawyer send over the unfinished manuscript he had been writing about Naso. Riveted, Mains devoured it in a single evening. I went back to Bill and I said, "All right, you got my attention now. What else you got?" Mains recalls. Nogueira then sent him a copy of Naso's 2-page letter about girl from Berkeley. The next day, Mains was 99% sure he had identified the victim. The detailed information in Naso's confession made it easy. Mains simply queried the NAMUS Missing Persons database for disappearances of young women in the 1960s or 70s involving a bicycle that was left chained at a restaurant in Berkeley. His search turned up the case of Lynn Ruth Kahns, a 20-year-old woman who had disappeared in 1976 after going to meet a photographer who responded to an ad she had placed in the Berkeley Barb. Police reports described her as 5 feet 4 and 110 pounds, and mentioned that her bike was found chained outside the Bateau Avery restaurant on Telegraph Avenue. Her body was never found. Before Mains would tell Berkeley police that he'd solved their case, there was one more thing Mains wanted Nogueira to do. He printed out a couple of photos of Kahns, a freckle-faced young woman with dark blonde hair parted in the middle and a small scar on her lower lip, and sent them to Nogueira, asking him to observe Naso's reaction to seeing them. By that time, Nogueira's job in the medically restricted yard had ended, so he wasn't in contact with Nasso as much as he had been before. He was awaiting transfer to another prison, which could happen any day without warning. But the day after the Las Vegas Raiders defeated the Jacksonville Jaguars in an NFL Hall of Fame game in August 2022, he knew Nasso would be in the yard wanting to recap the game. He was a huge sports fanatic. Nogueira kept the photos of Kahn's on him and wasn't surprised when he was called over from the adjacent yard by Nasso, asking what he thought about the game. Nogueira slipped the pictures of Kahn's through the fence without saying a word and noticed how Nasso began to excitedly stroke one of the photographs, asking how on earth Nogueira managed to find her. Nogueira repeated his refrain, "You know, Joe, I got a lot of friends in low places as well as high places." "She's one of my special ones," Nasso said, according to Nogueira, the girl from Berkeley. As Nogueira tells me now, everything in that one moment felt like it was all completely worth it. The last time Celeste Kahn's heard her daughter Lynn's voice was on Mother's Day in 1976. Had she known that Lynn was going to model nude for an unknown photographer, "I would have come all the way to California from North Carolina to stop you," she wrote in an open letter that was published in a local newspaper the following year. Celeste died in 1988. Lynn's gravestone, located right below her mother's in the Thomasville City Cemetery outside of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, still says missing. Lynn's younger brother, Lee Kahn's, 64, who oversees maintenance for the cemetery where those gravestones lie, met with Maines in May. After Maines showed him the letter Nasso wrote about the girl from Berkeley, Lee told Vanity Fair he's 99.9% sure that Nasso was responsible for Lynn's death. "It's a lot to process," he said. "It's amazing that after so long, there was anybody that had an interest in trying to solve it. We're lucky that Nogueira tried to get the ball rolling and was concerned enough to find out what happened." He is now considering updating his sister's memorial to reflect that she's no longer missing. "We were very close," he said. "It's been so hard to ever say she was deceased. It takes a bit to settle in." In 2023, Nogueira was loaded onto a bus and driven 250 miles south of San Quentin to Corcoran State Prison, carsick the entire way because he hadn't been in a vehicle in more than 30 years. The Ninth Circuit had reversed the overturning of Nogueira's conviction and resentenced him to life with no possibility of parole. This was not what Nogueira had hoped for, but it was a crack in the armor that allowed us to stick our foot in, says his lawyer, Andrew Nechev. He asked the court to invoke California's Penal Code 1385, which gives judges the authority to dismiss punishments deemed frivolous. In his brief, Nechev described how much criminal law has evolved in the past 40 years and urged the court to consider that the brain of an 18-year-old, the age at which Nogueira committed murder, is now understood to be undeveloped. He also wanted the court to consider the trauma of his client's upbringing, the poor legal representation he received at his trial, and the fact that the testimony backing the claims of special circumstances, that the motive for the murder was financial gain, was shown to have been coerced. "This case was so botched," Nechev told me, "having reviewed the appellate history, it's just astounding, the level of incompetence." To Nogueira's amazement, a conservative superior court judge in Orange County took interest in his case and ultimately agreed with his lawyer that the special circumstances were invalid. Over the summer of 2024, Nogueira was resentenced again to 25 years to life. But because he had already served more than 40 years, he was immediately eligible for parole. He didn't want to get too excited, because even if the parole board decided to release him, the governor had the right to reverse the decision. Nechev told me that he and Nogueira made a judgment call early on to stick to the merits of his case when dealing with the parole board, and not to mention any of Nogueira's freelance detective work. "We didn't think it would help," says Nechev, adding that securing his own freedom had never been Nogueira's primary motivator in working with Maines to solve cold cases. Indeed, Nogueira began working with Maines while he was still on death row, before he knew that parole would ever be a possibility. While Nogueira was waiting for his first parole hearing to be scheduled, he and Maines continued to focus on solving the remaining three murders on the list of 10. Girl near Heldsburg, number 1, girl on Mount Tam, number 4, and girl from Miami near Down Peninsula, number 5. They had reason to believe that girl on Mount Tam, short for Mount Tamalpais, a Marin County landmark, was the one that Naso bragged was incorrectly pinned on the dating game killer Alcala. In 2011, the Marin County Sheriff's Office held a press conference to announce they were confident that Alcala killed 19-year-old Pamela Jean Lamson 34 years earlier. Alcala was already incarcerated at San Quentin and was never charged with Lamson's murder. He always denied it, even as he admitted to other murders. Nogueira, referring to his consistency of behavior thesis, found this interesting. Also interesting were the circumstances of Lamson's disappearance. An aspiring singer and actor, Lamson vanished after meeting a photographer who had singled her out at an Oakland A's game, told her she was beautiful, and offered to help her with her headshots. She later went to meet the photographer at Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco and never returned. The police found her battered body posed in front of a trail leading to Mount Tam the next day. Based on what Naso told Nogueira, including how he hunted for victims at A's games, he went so far as to create fake press credentials and business cards. Maines was convinced that Naso was the real killer. Alcala didn't pose his victims, nor was he known to be in Oakland at the time of Lamson's disappearance, according to Maines. Naso was. The Lamson family had always questioned whether long-haired Alcala really fit the description of Pamela's killer. Her brother, Michael Lamson, now a 71-year-old plumbing contractor in Inglewood, California, says he will never forget what Pamela said before she left to meet the photographer at Fisherman's Wharf. When Michael expressed concern about who this random man was, she said, "He could be my dad, Mike," he recalls. At the time of Pamela's disappearance, Alcala would have only been in his early 30s, a decade younger than Naso, who was approximately the same age as Pamela's father. Michael told me that he and his brothers are now convinced that Naso is the real murderer. In 2024, Maines sent all of his notes on the Lamson case to the Marin County Sheriff's Office, but says he didn't hear back. While reporting this story, I left two messages there. I eventually received a call from Deputy Chief Adam Schermerhorn, the department's public information officer, who said that based on new information, Marin County's cold case team is currently trying to determine if Naso had any potential involvement with Lamson's murder. Given that the murder was pinned on Alcala, is the sheriff's office going to make an announcement that the case is being reopened? We do not have any announcement scheduled at this time, he told me. Using facial recognition, Maines says he was also able to match one of the photographs from Naso's collage that he gave to Nogueira to another potential victim who was not on the list of 10. Rebecca Jean Dunn, a Las Vegas sex worker who went missing in 1979. At the time, Nasso was spending a lot of time there after separating from his wife. He set up a photography studio near the strip, where he would hunt for victims, according to Nogueira. After receiving Maines's report about Dunn, the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department reopened the case, according to a person close to the matter, though the department's public information office wrote in an email to Vanity Fair that there are currently no new leads in this investigation. Last year, Maines met with Mark Mariano, a retired Rochester detective who in 2005 reopened an investigation into a series of three unsolved murders that took place there between 1971 and 1973. The victims, girls between the ages of 10 and 11, also had first and last names that started with the same letter. In an eerie detail, one of them was named Carmen Colon, the exact same name as one of Nasso's adult victims. Although Nasso has long denied any involvement in the Rochester double initial murders, he grew up there, rented an apartment there in the early 1970s, and recounted in his rape journal sex crimes in Rochester with girls he claimed were as young as 14. Nasso lived a stone's throw from where one of the victims, Wanda Walkowitz, was last seen, says Mariano, who retired in 2008. He says that until he met with Maines, he hadn't seen the rape journal, but when he read it, he was shocked to discover Nasso wrote about picking a girl up at Panorama Plaza, which was where one of the three victims, Michelle Maenza, was last seen alive. After reviewing the new evidence, Mariano contacted C.J. Zimmerman, Deputy Sheriff Sergeant at the Monroe County Sheriff's Office, to suggest reopening the case yet again and revisiting Nasso as a suspect. I said, "I'm not saying he's the guy, but I don't know how you could say he's not the guy," Mariano told Vanity Fair. According to Mariano, Zimmerman said that Nasso's DNA had already been tested against the one remaining sample from Walkowitz and was not a match. Mariano believes that owing to the amount of time that has elapsed since the samples were collected, DNA testing is probably unreliable. But Zimmerman said, "We're done with it." Reached over the phone, Zimmerman told me that he now believes that the three murders may have been committed by more than one person. Due to the DNA testing in the Walkowitz case, Nasso has been ruled out, but he is still considered a suspect in the two other Rochester murders. The girl from Miami near Down Peninsula, number 5, was always the most confounding of all the women on Nasso's list of 10. First, Miami didn't seem to fit Nasso's preferred geographic range. And second, Nasso was always reluctant to discuss this particular victim. He would only say, "I don't want to talk about her right now. She's very personal," recalls Nogueira. The only information he could get out of Nasso about the girl from Miami was that she was going to visit her sister and that she had been wearing a kick-ass jacket. At the time, Nogueira didn't write down the detail about the jacket. "I would go to the yard. The whole day would pass. And then I would come home to my cell and I would write these notes," he says. "Certain details would inevitably be forgotten." Maines had been combing through missing persons reports about young women from Miami who disappeared in the 1970s, but kept coming up empty-handed. Then one day, at the end of 2024, he was looking at the area in Oakland around MacArthur Boulevard, where Nasso maintained an office. Basically, just a one-bedroom flop house that he allegedly used to lure victims. He noticed that just to the north of MacArthur Boulevard is a tiny dead-end street called Miami Court. Maines cross-checked news reports about murders in that area and found several articles about Charlotte Cook, one of which appeared in a paper called the Peninsula News. I was like, "Oh, shit, the girl from Miami near Down Peninsula. That's got to mean something," Maines recalls. Not only did Cook have the type of alliterative name seemingly favored by Nasso, but news reports mentioned she was going to visit her sister in San Francisco at the time of her disappearance. Maines sent the articles to Noguera, and upon reading the detail about Cook's expensive camel hair coat, his mind flashed back to the moment Nasso had told him about the kick-ass jacket that the girl from Miami was wearing. Ultimately, it was Nasso's reluctance to discuss the girl from Miami near Down Peninsula that told Noguera everything he needed to know. Looking at her picture in the newspaper, he could see she was different from Nasso's other known victims, insofar as she was black. On a level 4 prison yard, racism is everything, explains Noguera. Whites hang out with whites, blacks hang out with blacks. Nasso, he speculated, must have known that if word got out that he killed a black woman, he would be marked for death. When Maines called the Daly City police to tell them that he'd solved their oldest active cold case in December, Detective William Reininger couldn't believe it. Reininger, who has been working as a detective for 2 years, already knew who Nasso was. In fact, he'd been looking at Nasso as a suspect in yet another murder, a Jane Doe who'd been strangled in 1987, but whose body was only identified last year. In reviewing both cases, I believe Charlotte Cook to be the victim in the list of 10, girl from Miami near Down Peninsula, Reininger told me in February, adding that he thinks there's a strong possibility that Nasso also killed the other victim. Reininger went to visit Nasso in June with Martha Parker, an FBI agent in the San Francisco field office, who broached the subject of pulling some strings and moving Nasso to a nicer prison if he agreed to provide them with some other information. Nasso ignored the offer at first and changed the subject. But when Parker abruptly said they had to leave, he turned to them and asked, "When you said other information, you meant cold cases, right?" recalls Reininger. They confirmed that they indeed were looking for information about cold cases. "Okay, I think I could do that," Nasso told them, according to Reininger. Nasso mentioned his desire to be moved to a prison in Vacaville near the Sacramento airport, which would make it easier for his sons to visit him. He also told them he had received a letter from a Vanity Fair reporter describing me as so rude for asking him about murders. Even though I didn't mention Noguera's name in any communication with Nasso, he speculated that a guy from the other prison, Noguera, had been talking to me and the cops about the girl from Berkeley and called Noguera a real snake, according to Reininger. Reininger says that he is speaking with the lead district attorney in San Mateo County soon to see if providing immunity in exchange for a confession would be an option. At press time, he and Parker plan to return to Stockton to interview Nasso. Parker has also been in touch with Maines. During the end of 2024, Maines says she called him and said she had been looking into Nasso for the past year on the Lynn Ruth Kahn's case alongside the Berkeley Police Department. An FBI public information officer responded by email that, per longstanding policy, the FBI cannot confirm or deny the existence of an investigation. Officer Jessica Perry of the Berkeley Police confirmed in an email to Vanity Fair that the department is currently investigating this Kahn's case and cannot comment on ongoing investigations, adding that we will issue a public statement with further details once the investigation is complete. Yuba County Sheriff Wendell Anderson has been acting as an informal liaison between different police departments in Northern California, Berkeley, Marin County, and Daly City. In March, detectives from each of the departments got together to get on the same page and share information, he says. Rehabilitation is a word people like to throw around, and they do not really know what it means, Maines wrote in a letter last November to the parole board. Mr. Noguera had spent 40 years on death row, a well-deserved punishment for his crime, in my opinion. Yet during that time, he chose to educate himself, help others, become a leader inside the prison, and do more than most would ever dare to do in San Quentin or any other prison. That is rehabilitation. Following a hearing last January, the board unanimously determined that Noguera was suitable for parole, meaning if the governor didn't block the decision, he would be released sometime in the next 150 days. In May, Newsom referred the case back to the full parole board for review, known as an en banc hearing. At issue was whether Noguera was psychologically fit to be able to transition to civilian life following 42 years behind bars. Just one day after his 61st birthday on June 18th, Noguera's parole was affirmed. But owing to an outstanding warrant from 1983, he was taken straight from Corcoran State Prison to the Los Angeles County Jail. Noguera was finally released on July 2nd on $50,000 bail. Noguera is living in transitional housing in Riverside, California for 6 months, after which he plans to move in with his sister and continue writing, making art, and podcasting, and working with Mains to solve more cold cases. Thanks to Noguera's work, Freedom Cook says she has been able to let go of decades of anger that had no place to go. Freedom has 4 kids of her own now, but she's not going to tell them about Naso until and unless he is convicted. Then, she says, that's when I will celebrate. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico.